The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It's Wednesday, February 11th, and we do have a quorum. Our first bill is Senator Bonoff's, Senate File 5. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And the reason why this bill is before you is because we have included in this bill is an exemption from rulemaking. And so before I go into why we need that exemption, I will take the time to give members just an overview of what the bill does so that you can understand it in context. So I did not bring testifiers to testify in support of the concept, thinking that for the purpose of this committee, we're really just dealing with that very finite piece of the bill. But overall, members, if you'll recall, last session, we passed legislation that that set forward the foundation for launching dual education in Minnesota. And we did so based on the European model, where dual education is really the fabric of that whole system. So, for example, in Germany and Finland, many, many students, when they leave the post-secondary, in fact, in Germany, it's 65% of the students, when they leave high school, are in some sort of apprenticeship. So if they're an accountant, if they're in manufacturing, if they're in many, you know, IT, almost everything with the exception of, say, if you're going to go the law track or the humanities, you're part of an apprenticeship. So what we did last session is we said, let's start it in four key emerging industries, and let's bring industry, higher ed together and say, could we do this? What would it look like? And so between the time when we finished our session last year and we stand here today, the Department of Labor and Industry conducted advisory council meetings. They've been 12 altogether, three for each industry, to say which jobs do you think we could try it in and how would we do it. So after all that effort, the bill moving this session says we would create a grant program where businesses could apply for the money, and they would only be eligible if they hired the student. So they'd be paying the student. They'd have an arrangement with a post-secondary institution. So, for example, let's say 3M wanted to hire somebody in their manufacturing plant. They would have an arrangement with a technical school or a university to provide the classroom instruction, and then we would send the grant money. They would apply telling us who the student was, where they were going to go, what they were going to study, and we would send the tuition assistance directly to the college or university. The idea being we want the education of our post-secondary students to be a shared burden, not just on the families and the state, but actually have businesses and industry have a stake in this so that they're helping to train these students. The key element in the German model is that in order for this not to be like a customized training, one-off system where you not have an efficient systemic approach, is they have competency standards that industry has agreed to for each of the jobs where apprenticeships occur. And so that's why we're here today before your committee, because in order for a student to be participating in the program, the Department of Labor and Industry has to verify and validate the competency standards. We do not believe that these competency standards should go through rulemaking, because they're industry competency standards, and they're going to be changing as the industry needs change, as technology changes. We want this program to be very flexible, and our assurance that, in fact, it's going to work is we've got the Department of Labor verifying it and working with the higher ed institutions and businesses. It would greatly inhibit our ability to be successful if we had to have for every job go through a state rulemaking procedure. And so in our bill, on lines 3.22 through 3.23, we say the identification of standards is not subject to Chapter 14. Now, I believe I haven't heard the outcome of this Senate Council. So the way it was drafted was in keeping with the way Mr. Fuller and who he consulted with recommended. There may be now some differences, and I haven't heard the result of that conversation.
It's okay.
Okay, so as I understand it, I do have an amendment now.
Okay.
Do you know I have the is? A10.
Senator Bonoff has the A10 amendment. Did you want to speak to your
amendment? I can, but would you like one of the members to move it so it's before you?
Senator Pappas. Senator Pappas moves the A-10 amendment.
Oh.
Does everybody have it? Okay. Any discussion? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Senator Bonoff, I'm just curious about exempting this from the rulemaking process provisions. Can you tell me how this might apply in other cases? Because there are people who don't want to go through the rulemaking process in other occasions. And would this be, has this been done many times before, or is this sort of a precedent?
Senator Scalzi, and so should I answer? I'll answer this question before addressing the amendment.
Sure.
Okay. Senator Scalzi, I think you just walked in, right?
No.
Oh, you heard my prior conversation about that we're talking about job standards, and what's really new isn't that we're exempting something from rulemaking. It's that for the first time we're having the state, the Department of Labor, actually verify what it would take to be approved for a particular job. So what's different in this bill is we're bringing the Department of Labor into, right now, the U.S. Department of Labor, if you go on their website, they list various jobs, and they have this pyramid and of what the skills and abilities are in order to fulfill each job. And so in order to get state money for tuition related to these jobs, we want to make sure that our taxpayer dollars are being used widely. So we want the Department of Labor to say, yes, this is a credential that will transfer, that will really help this student. And so the bill sets forward a process by which we have a role in saying that we're going to help assist students in their post-secondary education for jobs that a job has said it's needed. So I don't think that that the exemption from rulemaking changes anything that we would normally do in our day-to-day, because I think we're creating something that's brand new.
Any other questions?
In other words, I don't think we are setting a precedent with this.
Senator Bonoff, would you like to speak to your amendment?
The amendment? Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask counsel to do that.
Counsel.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment on lines 1.2 to 1.3 puts a competency standard definition in the first section of the bill, which is in Chapter 116L, and it just cross-references the definition that's established in the second section of the bill in Chapter 175. So it's really a housekeeping measure there. Lines 1.4 and 1.5, also housekeeping, so that the subject is singular like it is in the second part of the sentence. And then lines 1.6 through 1.9 are a replacement of that rulemaking sentence. The intent is the same. It should accomplish the same thing, but be clearer that the intention is that the competency standards are not rules and that you don't have to go through rulemaking or even exempt rulemaking in order to establish them.
Thank you, Ms. James. So Senator Pappas moves that the A-10 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Not seeing any. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And it passes. So,
I have a question.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoeff, I'm curious about the competency standards. So the Department of Labor will actually have to adopt the competency standards, and in case of, you know, public doubt or, you know, how do we go about clarifying the rule process is a process that we adopt to further clarify something that the public, you know, kind of may not understand, which was the purpose of the legislation. Could you explain how that works? I'm curious about what will be the mechanism that we have if we don't have a rule process. Is the department now responsible for doing that through the competency standards without rulemaking, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, if you look at the bill, we talk about the Department of Labor and Industry verifying competency standards, and based on U.S. Department of Labor. And we talk about establishing advisory councils. So we don't, as a state, establish rulemaking when we decide what does it mean to be a computer programmer or what does it mean to be a bookkeeper, because that's not in the purview of our state government. It's in the, you know, the industry sector. And so the legislation here addresses the industry sector. So the process whereby the Department of Labor is going to have agreed upon competency standards is going to be in conjunction with industry and subject matter experts from each industry. That's why we established in our previous bill in the four industries that we're beginning in, we already have advisory councils. We've got 50 different companies who participate in those, and higher education folks, and they began to set the first competency standards. So that's the process that takes place. In Europe, the Chamber of Commerce is probably the biggest outside group that helps set those standards, but it's a very similar process. We had the gentleman from the German consulate from D.C. come to our committee last week, where he shared about the way they set up their competency standards, and he said that our bill actually was the first time in this country that we are pursuing it in such a systemic fashion, and he applauded that effort. But John Rakowski from the Department of Labor and Industry is here if you want to ask him any questions. Jessica Luman, who is the Deputy Commissioner, and Heather McGannon from, she was hired from the College of St. Paul to be the project manager on this. They have been working very hard on setting up the process for verifying and establishing the competency standards.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Bonhoeff, could you or somebody else tell me what the impact has been over the last year since this has started, and what is the impact we expect to see?
Good, thank you. And I just want to clarify the pronunciation of my last name. I've let it go for 10 years at the legislature. I decided I'm addressing it now. There's no H in it, so it's Bonhoeff.
Bonhoeff?
Yep, no H. Okay.
Like Lowry?
Okay, so Senator, and it wasn't meant to insult you. I've just decided I'm taking it on, okay?
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you. So far, we have a lot of folks in the industry already starting now to think this way, and so 3M came before our committee, and they've already launched it. They're not waiting for us, and they've started hiring folks. They're doing the apprenticeships. They're actually paying 50% of the students' tuition. Land O'Lakes was here. We have many companies who have said, we want to be part of this. We were hosted, one of our advisory committees was hosted in Rochester, and they shared how they've been doing. They have a whole high school designed around facilitating these partnerships with business and the high school kids. I think you're going to see it really take off. The ultimate goal is that we get kids interested in the jobs that are needed, and that instead of finishing their college where they have a bunch of debt and then the company says they didn't get trained in what I needed, they're going to be paid while they're in school. So that's the earn while you learn component. And the company's going to kind of mentor them and shape them so when they're done, they're actually work ready. You know, you hear a lot about that kids don't have the soft skills. They don't know how to come in on time. They don't know how to write a memo. Well, if they're working there for the 1, 2, or 4 years while they're in school, they're a different person at the end of it. So the hope is to just kind of rebalance the way we've done the system. You know, in our country, you just put these kids in an institution. Sometimes, a lot of cases, they do these free internships or apprenticeships, and then you say, good luck, hope you pay your debt off, and I hope somebody hires you. And maybe that's not the best way.
Is good, there any further? Anything else? Any other discussion? Not seeing it. Senator Pappas?
And Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 5, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Great.
All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you very much. And Ms. James, thanks very much for your help.
Next bill would be Senator Nelson with Senate File 247.
Good afternoon, Chair Eaton and Committee. It's a pleasure to be in front of you. I do have the A1 amendment, if someone might move that.
So moved.
Senator Hall moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion, or would you like to explain it? Senator?
Actually, it's some technical changes, improvements, actually, that Ms. James sent to me last night, which actually do a better job of clarifying the criteria for those who serve on the advisory task force.
Thank you. Is there any discussion?
We don't have it yet.
Okay. Madam Chair, while that's being handed out, and I need a copy too, I would ask if someone might be willing to make the oral amendment to the A1 amendment. You know, I don't know if you want to adopt it all at one time, but I would like to fill in some of the dotted lines on page 7 of the bill.
It's the A4 amendment, correct?
Yes. Oh, it might be. I don't have the number in front of me here. It's the A4. If I could get a copy, please.
So are we amending the amendment? Or?
She's gonna, yes.
With the A4.
Okay. And your amendment to the A4 would be?
On page 7. It's filling in the blank. So 7.14 would be $500,000 for fiscal year 2016. And $500,000 for fiscal year 17. Line 7.17 up to 1% of each appropriation for administration. 7.19, $500,000 for fiscal year 16, $5,000 for 17. And again on 7.23, 1% appropriation for administration. And on line 7.25, $250,000 for fiscal year 16. And I will describe what those are for as I walk through
14.
The bill.
$500,000.
Just making sure we have all
yes.
Everything you said.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. James.
Do you want me to read it?
Sure.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, this would be an amendment to the A4 to add the following. Page 7, line 14, insert $500,000 in each of the two blanks. On page 7, line 17, insert 1% in the blank. On line page 7, line 19, insert $500,000 at each of the two blanks. On page 7, line 22, insert 1% One, since the percent is already there. And then on page 7, line 25, insert 250,000 in the blank.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the A4 amendment with the changes that Council just mentioned to be incorporated into it, I'll move that.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes. Senator, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. First, I would like to thank the nice bipartisan co-sponsorship on this bill, Senator Pappas, Senator Sharon, Senator Cohen, and Senator Rosen have also sponsored this important piece of legislation with me. What I thought I might do in our limited time today is introduce my testifier, who can talk a little bit about some of the great work that has already been done and why this bill is so important. With the committee's permission, I'd like to introduce Olivia Mastry. She's the executive lead at Act on Alzheimer's.
Ms. Mastry.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am the executive lead of Act on Alzheimer's, which is a voluntary statewide collaboration. It involves over 60 public and private organizations and hundreds of individuals seeking to address the impacts of Alzheimer's disease.
Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Olivia Mastry, and I'm executive lead of Act on Alzheimer's.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to express my support of Senate File 247, the Alzheimer's Research and Support Act. I'd like to share why Minnesota is uniquely positioned to capitalize on additional investment and innovative research in our state, especially if that research has a broad scope that can hold all of the work that is occurring in Minnesota and has been occurring over the past 3 years. To do that, I need to give you a very brief history on Act on Alzheimer's and how that came to be in order for you to understand the broader context that we have around Alzheimer's disease work in our state. The genesis of Act on Alzheimer's was in 2009 when the Minnesota legislature charged an Alzheimer's disease working group to create recommendations for our state to help us prepare for the public health crisis around Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. The work group convened and submitted over 30 recommendations to the legislature in January of 2011, and at that point their mandate was technically fulfilled. However, those who had been working on the legislation really wanted to see the recommendations implemented, and that gave rise to the creation of Act on Alzheimer's, which is a coalition. It is not owned or controlled by any organization. And underneath that coalition, organizations are able to leverage their time, their talent, and their resources to collectively work together to achieve those 30 recommendations, or what we call Minnesota's Alzheimer's State Plan. Our collective progress in this in the last 3+ years has really changed the landscape of Alzheimer's disease in our state. It has made us a national model as to what can be done when you connect the dots and collectively bring together all activities into one place and leverage change. And for that reason, we're the perfect state to make further investment around research in Alzheimer's disease and care. So I share this information and this background with you because it reflects on the capacity of our state to coordinate across organizations and to make the most of any investments that we make in the area of research. Minnesota has effectively prepared itself to be a laboratory around Alzheimer's disease today. It has set itself up to be an echo chamber for anything we learn and an accelerator for that learning. And if we can use that and invest in things like traditional research around Alzheimer's disease that is implemented by some of the great organizations in our state already doing that work, the University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, the VA, and Health Partners, we will be on our way to adding another element to the work that Act on Alzheimer's has fostered through its collective activity over the past 3 years. Given this context, and given the fact that there are a number of dots to connect around the current work being done around Alzheimer's disease, a research council that would oversee and intentionally choose the best choices for where research should be applied in our state is really a very important next step in this process, and would be an exceptional way to make sure that any research investment would spread across our state in the best way possible. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information, and I welcome questions, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm just kind of curious because I see Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And I guess as we go through this, I'm assuming that you include other dementias as well as Alzheimer's. It's just too much to say at one
time. It is. It's just a long thing to say. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our testifier, can you tell me what recent breakthroughs we've had with Alzheimer's?
Ms. Mastry.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In terms of breakthroughs, in terms of Alzheimer's research, we've had a number of research around care and support with this disease, helping us to better understand what happens when you detect the disease early, and then what happens when you manage it well after the disease is detected. We've also learned a lot through some economic modeling under Act on Alzheimer's around the way we can slow the growth of costs around this disease if we provide caregivers with in-person support. So we're learning a lot about what is treatment for the disease. There isn't as much, however, in the area of prevention or cure.
Thank you.
Thank you. See, my understanding is the purview of this committee is the Advisory Council establishment.
Yes, Madam Chair. Would you like me to speak to that?
Please.
Okay. What I thought I might do real briefly is I must thank Senator Torres Ray and other senators in this room who were instrumental, really, in preparing Minnesota to lead on Alzheimer's. And what we're bringing you today is actually out of the good work that this legislature already did, and it's recommendation number 7 in the Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's, the budgetary, social, and personal impacts. Recommendation 7 is intensify research and surveillance. And so I will just thank you for that good work that has already been done, and we will seek to build upon that. And just briefly, the reason it is so incredibly important, and I know you all know this, so I'm going to spare you all the numbers, except to say that the incidence of Alzheimer's is growing at a skyrocketing rate. And I think we all know family members and loved ones who have this disease. Now, what we might not know is how that impacts our entire society and as policymakers, how it impacts and will impact our state and federal budgets. In 2020, the percentage of Alzheimer's, Minnesota seniors living with Alzheimer's is 13%, and then the percent change by 2025, it increases by 36%. And just to help you grab your mind around these staggering numbers and why this is so important, today 10,000 baby boomers woke up and turned 65. And tomorrow, another 10,000. And each and every day for the next 19 years, we will have another 10,000 baby boomers. And the reason that's important is because 1 out of 9 people age 65 already have Alzheimer's. And by the time a person turns 85, the incidence rises to 1 out of 3. It is a significant trajectory, and we must address it, and we can lead on that. I will leave a report for you called Changing the Trajectory on Alzheimer's Disease, and you'll get one page out of that, hopefully delivered to your spot right now, so you can just see that graphically, but it is well worth a quick read on this, and that's what I'm hoping this bill will do, Changing the Trajectory. Which brings me to the part that this committee is so is really in the jurisdiction of this committee, and that is the development of the Alzheimer's Research Grant Program. So this bill seeks to $5 million for Alzheimer's research, and we have limited resources. $5 million is a lot of money, but compared to the massive need, it is a small amount of money for what the need is. And so the key is that we focus our limited resources on those grant proposals that have the greatest chance, that are most likely to develop to determine causes, cures, prevention, and treatment. And you know, I will tell you, I'll tell this committee, as someone who's not a fan of growing government, I really looked at this hard about, is this the best way to do this, to develop an Alzheimer's research grant program? It truly is because we have to make sure that these limited resources are actually doing the most good. And I would like to tell you about the Alzheimer's Research Advisory Council. I think that's the part that is of interest to this committee. It's on page 2 of your bill. And the membership, I think, is what is so critical. And so just allow me to read that for you. 2 gerontologists, 2 geriatric psychiatrists, 2 geriatricians, 2 neuroscientists, and 3 neurologists. And it's an 11-member board that is appointed by the commissioner. The rest of the language is really pretty much boilerplate that kind of follows what we do as far as our advisory councils. There is one point of interest I do want to mention to this committee, because I kind of wrestled with this also. And this has to do with line 2.22, and it had to do with a conflict of interest. So if we were to eliminate all of the experts who could help determine what's the best use of these limited grant dollars, we might not get those grants having the greatest chance of changing the trajectory of Alzheimer's funded. So the conflict of interest is just a tad different than some of our other conflict of interest things. Basically, it does require that we don't want to remove all the experts in Alzheimer's, basically, but yet there needs to be full disclosure about anything that they may or may not may be involved in as that comes forward. So it was, I think, the best way to make sure that we can actually get the experts around the table to determine what's the best use of those grant dollars. So, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to walk through the entire bill if that is the will of the committee. But I will tell you, it is the Alzheimer's Research Advisory Council which would recommend to the Commissioner of the Office of Higher Education, because that's how we fund research in this state, which grants have the greatest chance of success. And the amendment you adopted today further defined that those members must have professional expertise in Alzheimer's and related biomedical research. And to Senator Scalzi's point, this bill also deals with Alzheimer's and other dementias. Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. So it is Alzheimer's and other dementias. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Pappas, I'm wondering if I could ask your expertise on if all the pieces are here that we need for... I'm not seeing a way to start it. There's no date to, or anybody to...
I think you should ask Ms. James to see if they're all here.
Madam Chair and members, yes, I've reviewed this against the guidelines this committee typically considers for these sorts of councils, and it works. It provides for the appointments to it gives a deadline by which they need to submit their make its criteria. It makes it effective at the start of the fiscal year. I think, though, that what you've noticed is that it doesn't set a deadline for the first appointments.
Exactly.
And so that is something that would be good to add. So I'm happy to suggest an amendment. This would be an uncoded section. So it would be inserted in at the end of or after line. Oh, here's the initial terms, actually. I knew they were here. They're in Section 7, which is on page 7, lines 1 through 7. And they're uncoded because they just get it started. And it provides for the first members to be appointed by September 1st, 2015.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nelson, I assume that on page 2.11, the commissioner is the commissioner of the Office of Higher Education. Is that correct?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that is correct.
Then thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nelson, could you explain to me then what is the role of the Minnesota Board on Aging on page 3? And how does it, is that a separate grant process, or is that the same? Just explain the difference.
Yes.
There.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair, Senator Pappas? Yes,
that
is an excellent question, and I appreciate the opportunity to explain that. So the Minnesota Board on Aging will determine the grant criteria and select the grantees for the statewide dementia grants, the regional and local dementia grants, and for the Alzheimer's Public Information Program. And that, it does not run through the advisory board. That is purely on the scientific medical research. I would like to tell you about these important statewide, though, and regional grants. They are the qualifying characteristics that they need to do that will place them in good standing for receiving the grants. They must promote the awareness of Alzheimer's and other dementias. They must increase the rate of cognitive testing in the population at risk for dementias, and they must promote the benefits of early diagnosis of dementias and connect caregivers of persons with dementia to education and resources. And that would be especially looking at the existing resources. And that is for the statewide grants, and the similar criteria for the regional and local dementia grants.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Is there any further discussion? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, I was just thinking that it would be a good idea to encourage the board and in the future to figure out how to seek partnerships with companies and corporations who invest in this kind of research, because we're never going to be able to invest enough really to do what we need to do. And I think you are the perfect person to encourage some of our institutions, you know, the Mayo Clinic and others who already have these partnerships. So just as a something that you might want to pursue and put in here to increase resources for research, because I think that I think we're going to run into barriers. So I don't know if you need legislation for that, because eventually this council may have to, you know, pursue yes. that and figure out how to manage that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Senator Torres Ray, well, I think you are right on the money, so to speak, when you talk about the fact that we have limited resources and we need to look at research from all aspects. We need to encourage research in the private sector as well. We can't mandate that at the state level, but we can encourage that. And certainly, I would look forward to visiting if there's any way that we need to encourage that in this bill. I'm certainly willing to examine that and would visit with you how to do that. On the other hand, I know that we can't at the state level mandate how those private companies spend their resources, but it is, to Senator Torres Ray's point, it is in everyone's best interest that we really look at changing this trajectory on Alzheimer's, and it only will happen through research. And we do have the leading Alzheimer's researchers here in this state already. We have Alzheimer's researchers who advise the G8, who advise the feds, who are already heavily involved, but the lack of the research dollars are very scarce. And the thing about this bill is it is very laser focused on those things that will change the trajectory. That is the causes, the prevention, the cures, and the treatments.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson and Ms. Mastry. I really want to thank you for the very comprehensive approach that you're taking here. It does take a whole village to care for someone with Alzheimer's. And I know a number of us on the bill have experienced that in our own families. I think if my mother had had a more supportive senior building, she would not have, I think, prematurely ended up in a memory care facility, because it just takes some understanding that sometimes people have things that are going on with them, like my mother had a UTI, and they don't know. They can't really express what the problem is. They just are in pain. And she was basically kicked out of her building, and we were forced to move her, I think, prematurely after we kept her home for quite a while with a disease, because it has a very long, typically very long trajectory, mm-hmm. you know, 10 or 20 years. And we can't be putting people into memory care facilities or into nursing homes so young. It's just way too expensive, and it's unnecessary, that level of care. So we tried, but at a certain point when she, you know, they said they couldn't handle her anymore. And I think if there had been more education and more understanding and more availability of services, that she probably could have stayed at home longer.
Madam Chair?
Thank
Madam
you.
Chair, Senator Pappas, you are exactly right about that. We have experienced the very same thing in my family, and that's where the second part of the bill, the grants to the Minnesota Board on Aging, are so critical in helping develop those caregiver support, using resources that we already have. We already have the framework and foundation for, like the senior linkage line. We can tie that in closer with Act on Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Organization, Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's. We do have the building blocks here, and we just need to better connect people to use those, and that will be part of those Board on Aging resources. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Yeah. Senator Wicklin?
Thank you, Chair, Chair Eaton. I just wanted to make a comment similar to Senator Torres-Ray and encourage that in making the recommendations that there's coordination with the federal research projects and federal grant money that's
yes.
going out. And, you know, since this is so limited compared to the magnitude of other research dollars that are out there, I just think it's important that this council, that they be pretty focused on making sure they're coordinating with other grant work that's going on. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator,
Senator Wicklin, that is very well noted. I think that's a very good suggestion. Much needed. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move Senate file.
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate file 247 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. Do you have to go to any other policy committees?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I believe we need to see it in higher education. Senator Bonhoff would like to see this bill.
Madam Chair, in the policy committee?
Finance. Higher education finance.
Finance.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Right.
That's what you meant. Yes, ma'am.
And you didn't have to go to health and human services policy?
We've been there.
Oh, all right. Then I was right, to finance.
Yes, you're correct.
Okay. So Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 247 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Finance and Higher Ed. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Our next bill would be Senate File 336, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment.
And the A2 amendment should be in your packets, members?
Okay. Then I would move the A2 amendment.
I think it's A6.
Oh, it's A6? Oh, I'm sorry.
A6.
It's the A6.
It's the A6.
Just an author's amendment. As this is an author's amendment, you've moved it. So all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you,
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and members. last session, you may remember voting in favor of a similar bill to this one. It passed the House and Senate unanimously. It provided employer-paid benefits to employees at correctional facilities who are assaulted by offenders and rendered totally and permanently disabled as defined under the laws governing the Minnesota State Retirement Systems. The bill was prompted by an investigator at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Stillwater who suffered traumatic brain injury at the hands of a known gang leader and inmate. I believe he was trying to break up a fight and fell, was knocked backwards. There's an article in your packet about that case. The investigator was totally and permanently disabled and will suffer after effects the rest of his life. This bill was restrictive. It did not include employees in the Correctional Retirement Plan or employees at the Minnesota Security Hospitals or the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So this legislation expands the law to include those other facilities. It requires the Department of Corrections and the Minnesota Department of Human Services to pay for the employer's share of insurance premiums for any employee who becomes totally and permanently disabled as a result of an offender or patient assault. These payments would begin when the employee is determined to be totally and permanently disabled. At that time, they generally used up all of their workers' compensation, their vacation time, their sick leave, and any kind of pay has been exhausted. And since that situation makes it nearly impossible for them to ever work again, they're heading down the road for unintended hardship and financial ruin. Last year, the Department of Corrections estimated that up to two of their employees every 15 years would meet this threshold, and they agreed to absorb the cost. I have with me Mr. Richard, his last name I can never pronounce.
Kajewski.
Kajewski. From MAPE, to add to any of my comments or to answer any of your questions.
Mr. Kajewski.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director from MAPE, and Senator Pappas did a great job describing the bill, and I'm happy to assist in answering any questions.
Any discussion by the members? Not seeing any. Senator Pappas moves.
Madam Chair, I'll move that we're just consulting whether it needs to go to finance or human services. Yes. Does anyone ask for the bill?
Health and Human Services Policy has requested the bill.
So I'll move that Senate File 336, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Passes. Our next bill is Senate File 175, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. I have Senate File 175. I do have an amendment at the advice of counsel, just a technical amendment that I'd like to move. So, Madam Chair, if I can move the A1 amendment.
Do we have that?
Oh, here it comes.
Okay. Everybody have the amendment? Very small. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 175, this proposed legislation transfers the authority of the eight regional emergency medical systems for emergency medical service. For the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, or EMSRB, it's a mouthful, to the Minnesota Department of Health. The eight regional EMS programs provide assistance and coordinate all EMS activities in around Minnesota. They work closely with all of the other healthcare disciplines to coordinate the EMS delivery system. The regional program aligns well with the mission of the Minnesota Department of Health, who oversees the stroke, cardiac, and trauma program. The EMSRB does not have the resources to properly manage the grant. At this point, it is a small agency. This also removes the possible conflict of interest that EMS and other providers in the Emergency Medical Service Regulatory Board approve current grants. The proposal has been vetted by the EMSRB Board, the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and the Minnesota Department of Health. With me to discuss today the particular part that this committee, provisions that this committee will look at, is Mr. Buck McAlpin.
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and members, thanks for having us on the Senate file. We've worked probably the last couple years having this discussion about our eight regional emergency medical services programs. They're funded about $156,000 biannually from the general fund, and then they receive 90% of all primary seatbelt funds. That's usually funneled through, and grants have been issued by the EMS Regulatory Board. Our EMS Regulatory Board is unique, and we've worked with the board on that. They've been funded off grant administration. And this is one of those areas that we have looked at from the industry working with them that myself as a paramedic or a firefighter or a sheriff can sit on this board, and then we vote on grants that indirectly would come back to your region. And the Attorney General has made comments in the past that we should look at moving these to a neutral entity. And although the Department of Health hasn't asked for them. We've worked with them to say that they would agree to take them on. They're not actively out lobbying to take this. We've worked with all the entities to try to make this a smooth transition to move them over there and keep these eight regional programs functional. The board said they don't have the staff to issue the RFPs that were due in January, so we have to work with the Health Chair Committee Chair, Chairman Lori, to figure out how we extend these grants and issue new RFPs after June 30th. Their real focus is rural, small EMS systems that they work with.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. McAlpin or Senator Hayden?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 175 as amended be passed and referred to, I think, the Committee on Health, HHS Finance.
Correct. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Just sipping over. Our next bill is Senate File 421, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an author's amendment. It just makes two small changes, adds an effective date, and removes the word certain from the heading, since this is brought, this bill will make it apply to all cities. It didn't seem to be reasonable to have the word certain in. I think you have the amendment.
I do. It's the A1 amendment. It's in your packets. Does everyone found it? Okay. All those in favor of the author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you. I'm here today with a bill by way of the City of Bloomington. Bloomington is in the process of looking at moving to an organized waste collection system. As part of that process, they're examining all of the factors involved in making the decision, and one of those factors is how to address unpaid waste bills. If people aren't paying their bills, what will happen to that? In a non-organized system, if a hauler has unpaid bills, they can discontinue service. But if it's an organized collection system, there needs to be some mechanism to deal with the unpaid bills. So this bill would clarify current statute language to make sure that home rule charter cities like Bloomington can assess residents who do not pay their bills, just as statutory cities can currently. It would be similar to an assessment that is done for not cutting your grass or getting rid of weeds. That kind of an assessment would be made for an unpaid garbage bill. So today I have Carl Keel. He is here, the Director of Public Works for City of Bloomington, who can add some additional information.
Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Senator Wicklund indicated, the City of Bloomington is in the process of considering whether we would go to an organized collection system, and one of the key issues that came up was this issue of assessment of unpaid bills. Currently, haulers that are not paid have the option to cease service to residents that don't pay. Under an organized collection system, that option is not available. They had indicated to us that at any time, between 10 and 15% of their accounts may be in arrears on payment. And so really having an ability to collect those is a very significant component of running an organized collection system. So not having this ability really relates to a much higher, or kind of directly ends up in higher costs to our residents. So we are very interested in making sure that we have the ability to assess these unpaid bills, much like we do for unpaid water or sewer bills for our residents. So it's an important part of that consideration. I think really the statute currently specifically outlines that statutory cities and cities of the first and fourth class have ability to do this, have very explicit ability to do this, and it's silent on all other communities. Bloomington happens to be a home rule city of the second class, So it's unclear whether we have this authority or not. And so we're asking that this be clarified, because for us it's an important part of being able to offer an organized collection system.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Mr. Senator Hall.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and testifier. So in listening to Senator Wicklund, is this collection is the same thing as what would happen if somebody didn't cut their grass or cut their weeds?
It's similar to that. I would say it's more directly similar to how we would collect assessments for unpaid utility bills, water and sewer bills.
Okay. So not grass or weeds.
Correct. We do have the ability. That's a different way to assess items.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so these are private companies, though, that are collecting the garbage in, say, Bloomington, and it's not a city. It's not like Minneapolis that has their own garbage collectors. I think they do. Maybe they don't either.
Mr. Keel.
Madam Chair, typically, organized collection systems can be run one of two ways. One is the community themselves hires the actual hauler or the folks to do the hauling and the equipment, or they contract with a private entity. We are talking about the second option, that is the city would hire or have a contract with a private hauler that would do this work. I would note in Minneapolis they have a sort of a combination of the two. Part of their system is run by city forces and some of their system is collected by private haulers. But this would be a city service offered, and we would provide that service contractually. So this is would be assessment of fees that are for a city service.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not clear yet. Is the bill then given to the city, or is the bill sent to the private company?
Mr. Madam Chair, Senator Hall, that detail has not been determined yet. Again, there's two ways that could be done. The city could do the bill collection, or oftentimes the city contracts with the private hauler to do the bill collection. So that's a decision that has to be made yet. And if I were to guess, I think in our case, we would likely prefer having the hauler collect the bills. But that is a fine point that would have to be figured out yet.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this will be my last one. My concern is this. If you've got a private company, I think any private company that somebody doesn't pay them, I'd love to have the city be the bill collector. And have to deal with that and just assess them. But if they're a private company, and especially if the bill goes to the company and not to you, I question whether that should happen. And I'm just thinking through this thing now as it goes. But, I can understand when it's something that directly is a service from the city. But in these cases, it's a private company. I don't want to reiterate again, but that would be my question. I probably have to vote no on this.
Mr. Keel.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall. Again, there are a number of instances. I would give another example where cities do assess costs that are for things that are paid for by a private hauler or a private entity. In our disease treat program, for instance, we contract with private haulers or private tree removal companies to do that service. Non-payment of that is handled much the same as we're proposing. That would be through assessments. But also note that really the issue of payment of these types of fees is offered in state statute, and that's allowed by state statute. It's clearly offered for statutory cities, these of the first and fourth class. Really what we're saying is that same flexibility and ability to offer to use assessments should be offered to all cities.
Okay. I understand Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities would like to testify. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just very briefly, we worked with the City of Bloomington as they prepared this language. It does benefit a great number of cities beyond the City of Bloomington who are trying to figure out the best way to handle solid waste collection. Would remind members that cities are actually required to assure that residential garbage service is provided to people who live within their jurisdiction. And so giving us this ability to make sure that when we meet that obligation, we can also not leave the taxpayers on the hook for unpaid bills is a pretty important part, especially in a larger community. So very much appreciate the committee's support of the bill.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure which mic I'm supposed to use here, but forgive me if I missed this. Did you guys talk about sort of what would need to be done in the event that you didn't get this approval via the legislative path? So in other words, in order to get this done via your charter, did you talk about the alternate way in which you could accomplish this task in the city of Bloomington or this policy change?
Mr. Keel.
Madam Chair, Senator, we are seeking this for the main purpose that is a gray area in the law currently. And if we were to go through this process, we would expect that we would have assessments that would have to be levied, and that there's a chance that people would object to those assessments. And we wanted to make sure that we had a very clear authority to do so. If we were not to have this amendment, we have to take a closer look at our charter to see if the existing language which exists in our charter would allow this, and if we're willing to go ahead with that. Alternatively, we would have to not offer or not use this tool to collect, and that would result in higher fees to our residents to provide service.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't it true, though, that you're not unclear about whether the charter allows or doesn't allow this to happen, that your city attorney, in fact, has advised that in order to get this done, that you would need to alter your charter via a citywide referendum, which would be consistent with your city's constitution, and so that in order to avoid that process, you're here at the legislature seeking a legislative change as opposed to changing your charter by the city's constitutional parameters.
Mr. Keel.
Or charter parameters.
Madam Chair, Senator, our city attorney has opined that this is an area that she is not comfortable that we have clear authority on. There is language in our charter that could be construed to mean that there is the ability to do this. That is a point that is unclear. We've had others have indicated that we may actually have that authority. That is a point that if we do not have this clarification to make it clear, that we would have to solve that on our side.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I guess the point is you could call it a clarification, or one could call it a legislative end run around the other remedy, which would be to utilize the process that you have within your jurisdiction to bring that clarification via voter referendum, like any other alteration to your charter or clarification to your charter. Is that true or is that not true?
Mr.
Madam
Keel.
Chair, I believe that's not true. I think that the question is that the state law, which supersedes the charter, is unclear on this point, and we want to make sure that that is very clear, that we don't believe it's an issue of the language of the charter, but rather it's state laws, the exclusion of ability of all cities to do this, that is the issue, not so much the charter.
Mr. Johnson, did you have something you wanted to add?
Madam Chair and members, just to respond to that question, I wanted to point out this does affect beyond individual charter cities that are involved here. Currently, the law allows cities of the first and fourth class to have this assessment authority. This change would make it so cities of the second and third class would also have that authority, charter or statutory.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very well. I still think we're talking about a distinction without a difference. If you're suggesting that your city attorney has said that it's unclear that you have the authority to do this, and therefore you should go to the legislature to clarify, if you want to use that term, to give you the authority, then your city attorney is saying that your city charter does not clearly allow you to do it, and the remedy to change that language in your situation in the city of Bloomington would be to go to the voters of Bloomington to have that put into the charter. Is that not a remedy to be able to go to the voters of Bloomington and actually do it in a way that would allow your citizens to do it, rather than trying to find a statewide one-size-fits-all solution for all the cities, when in fact it may be just Bloomington that is the city that really is trying to find this remedy, or at least the one that instigated this conversation.
Senator, or Chair Eaton, may I make a comment?
Senator,
I'd also like to say that it was also a lack of clarity because there is some place in statute, and I don't know if Senate Counsel could help me with this, where if a rule or if a provision doesn't specifically state the charter city, that there is some recognition that if it does state it for a statutory city, that the charter city can follow that if it is provided. And I don't have the citation here, so which is to say they could follow that clause in statute that they may assess for unpaid waste collection, because that's spelled out in here for statutory cities.
Senator Peterson.
Well, I would imagine at some point, and I couldn't articulate exactly why, but there's a reason why there's a distinction between the various authorities that are laid out for statutory cities and charter cities and all of those sorts of things. But clarification is the same. A lack of clarification is the same as a lack of perceived legal authority, right? And so what you're attempting to do is not utilize the local remedy to provide that clarity, which you could do via a change to your city charter, which there's a remedy to do, and instead you're at the legislature seeking an alternative remedy to do it via statute to change the underlying authority for charter cities. Is that, am I incorrect in saying that?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Keel.
Senator, I believe you are incorrect in saying that. What we're saying is that the state statute is the point of that's not clear. It's not an issue of the charter. We're saying that the lack of specific authority in the state statute for home rule cities could be construed to mean that supersedes, that does not give us the authority to do this, which would supersede our local charter. So it's not an issue of our local charter. It's really an issue of the state statute.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am trying to figure out Senator Peterson's kind of reason, the questioning. It seems obvious to me that when a city or a local entity has a problem implementing policy because the state policy is unclear, that the first step will be to come here and actually ask us to clarify. It just seems like Senator Wicklund is doing precisely what we need to do. Now, if that doesn't pass, if we vote no and believe that this should not be clear, obviously they go to point B. But I am not clear. I believe that Senator Wicklund is doing precisely what we are supposed to do on behalf of our cities and our counties and our local authorities when they are not able to move forward with implementing and doing what they have to do at the local level, because there is an obstacle that we created by putting in place some policy that is unclear. If it was clear, they would not be here. It is unclear, so she's asking us to clarify that. It is our decision to say yay or nay, obviously. But I don't know. It seems to me that Senator Wicklund is doing precisely what we need to do. Step one, then if we don't do clarifying with step one, then they will proceed to do the local authorities, not the other way around, because they cannot move all of these things locally in order to clarify state policy, investing all of those resources to clarify what we did, then what? They are in the same place. Then they're going to have to come back to us after they've done all of these local process to ask, you know, their constituents and the local people to say yeah or no. They are still in the same place. They are going to have to come back and ask us. So I don't quite get the process.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray. Do you guys have the opinion that you're working off of from the city attorney, from City Attorney Johnson? Is that am I correct on the name? I wish I had it with me. Do you have that opinion here, that correspondence that is sort of the underlying basis for this request?
Madam Chair, I do not have a copy of that with me.
Because I think that correspondence, Madam Chair, would give us more clarity on exactly what her legal interpretation was, which you're saying is the impetus for why you're here in the first place. So, and I had it at one point, and I don't have it with me now. So I guess we'll have to make that decision. It would seem to me that it would be something you'd want to have here if that is, like I said, the basis for the entire piece of legislation. But Madam Chair, I guess I'll just we'll have to do without.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, would you say that this legislation would be helpful to many other cities across Minnesota?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so 2 years ago, the legislature acted to remove barriers for cities to implement organized collection in places where they were hoping to do that. We've had one city do it since then. This sort of fix would make it easier to work out contracts with haulers to do organized collection because it provides an answer to part of the how will we assure that collection happens. A lot of cities, when they do organized collection, actually do just write a single check on behalf of the city to the hauler. The city then is responsible for making sure that the collection happens and that the service, you know, is taken care of. The hauler's only job is to pick up the garbage every week and collect the check from the city each month. So we have a number of cities that do it that way, and this would be a very useful tool if that's how they end up deciding to organize their waste hauling in the community.
Thank you.
Just one more, Madam Chair, just if the city of Bloomington could provide my office with that correspondence from the attorney Johnson, that would be great in the interim time period.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, could you tell me why they did not include the home rule charter in the original setup of this legislation?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, we had one of our attorneys do research on this. I did not bring that along, but the original authority was actually from the early 1940s, and it was given at that point to cities of the first class. Cities of the fourth class were added later as an addendum when some cities of the fourth class asked for that authority. It's just never been looked at as a should we open this up for all cities before is the best answer I have. We have no record that it was ever discussed and that cities of the second and third class were not included intentionally.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, does this then open it up to all cities? This would take care of it. So why not just say any city here instead of statutory or home rules charter?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, I would defer to counsel for what the best wording is. I didn't draft exactly how this worked in the statute, but the intent was to just fix existing statute to make it clear that any statutory or home rule charter city is able to use this. And any city would have the same description as long as that's consistent with how city is described in this section of law. I don't actually know how that is defined in this section of law off the top of my head.
Ms. James, do you have any recommendations?
Madam Chair, that would be Council Stengel's area.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The appropriate term when you're trying to capture all of cities is to say home rule charter or statutory city to make it very clear. When you say something along the lines of what was already in here, or if you just say city, there's some question as to whether that's statutory or home rule charter cities, and then we end up having these conversations again. So it's best to just put it all in there if you do mean any city.
Makes sense.
Senator Wicklund, would you like to amend that or not?
No.
Okay.
Chair Eaton, I'd like to leave it the way it is because I think that best portrays what we were trying to accomplish.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Wicklund moves that Senate File 421 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the floor. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. I believe that's it, isn't it?
She declared
we've completed today's work and the committee is adjourned.
That. So I kind of